To call the first meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee to order. With that, I hope everyone had a good, prosperous, healthy, safe, fun interim. And we look forward to a fast, abbreviated session here, but getting a lot of good work done for the people of Minnesota. Then I want to introduce a new member of our committee. Representative Anderson, welcome. Why don't you take 30 seconds and give us a little background on who you are and where you serve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chad Anderson from Bloomington, wife and four kids, ages 6, 4, 3, and 1. By trade, I'm a real estate agent and property manager of apartment buildings, and my current committees are this one, along with aging and long-term care, and transportation and finance.
Excellent. Well, welcome, Representative Anderson. We're glad that you're on the committee.
My favorite.
With that, we have a couple of new pages with us as well this session. Are you guys both in the room right now? Why don't you come on down, bud, and just introduce yourself to the room and to the committee members.
Yes. I'm Matt Wienius. I'm the page for this committee, and along with Nick Nigro. He's currently not in the room, but we'll be around.
All right. Well, welcome, Matt. Thank you. Nick's out working. We'll try and catch him again at the end, but thank you. Thank you very much. Members, before we get going, too, I want to make note, the committee rules are back in your folders, and to those in the crowd or listening, the committee rules are also listed on the website for the committee, so I want to make sure everybody has a chance to refamiliarize themselves with the rules that we will operate under this session as well. So please make sure that you take a look back through those, because we will be operating under those rules. With that, we'll move on to the first bill of the day that we have in front of us. This is House File 1109, Representative Scott. Members, this is a bill, as she's coming to the table, that we heard and passed last session under the General Register, under Rule 4.20 under the House, because it was on the General Register. We have it back in front of our committee today. So with that, Representative Scott, I'll let you go ahead and make a motion on your bill.
I'd like to move House File 1109 be passed and referred to the General Register.
Representative Scott moves House File 1109 to be referred to the General Register. Representative Scott, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1109 is in response to the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report from November of 2014, they made the following recommendations regarding Minture and the Department of Human Services. The Department of Human Services should verify the complete and accurate transfer of all recipients' data from Minture to DHS's medical payment system. And the second recommendation is the Department of Human Services should log and monitor when Minute employees access recipients' personal information in the Department of Human Services medical payment system. And so this bill is a fix for that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And again, members, we passed this bill last session. Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott. I got an email earlier today saying something about from the Department of Administration, and I know it's custom practice that bills that came out of our committee and go that we send them right back. But there was a question that they said there's a cost to the administration of this bill. Did this in the past go through state government finance, if there's a cost that's identified with it or not? I guess that's my question. And if it isn't, should it be sent there if there is a cost on the administration? Otherwise, if we do send it to the floor, it's going to have to get sent back if there's that gets brought up on the floor.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Nelson. It's my understanding that last session this bill did not have a fiscal note. And it was sent to the General Register. At that point in time, apparently they suspended, for whatever reason, their work on a fiscal note. So not sure why they did that. So as far as we can be certain today, they may think there's a fiscal cost. They may reinitiate that process, but there is not a fiscal note on this bill at this point in time. So we will send it back to the General Register, and if there is a fiscal note, at that point in time, Representative Scott and the appropriate finance chair can deal with the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just also like to read what statute says about this. This is when House File 5 was passed in 2013 without a single Republican vote. This is what statute says. All queries and responses and all actions in which data are entered, updated, accessed, or shared, or disseminated outside of MNSURE must be recorded in a data audit trail. Data contained in the audit trail are public to the extent that the data are not otherwise classified by this section. So in House File 5, the legislature said that there should be audit trails for any time that this information is shared outside of MNSURE. They knew that when they drafted their fiscal note, their ask of the legislature to pay for MNSURE. And $360 million into this, already for MNSURE, $360 million is what we put into this website. Now they're going to come back and ask for more money. So that I find that troubling. It should have been included in the cost of what the original bill said.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott. I'm not arguing the benefits of the bill or any of that. I just said I received this email, and I know this is a different bill from the original MNSURE bill, and they're saying there's a cost. I just wanted to make it aware and make it public, you know, so we have it on the record that if there's a cost, that's going to have to go through a finance committee. So that's bring it. Like I said, I know the standard practices, and I agree with the motion that we have on the floor to send it back to the general register, because that's where it was, because that's what we normally do. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, if I move that. A couple questions for you. So for benefit of new member and maybe folks in the audience that didn't know this, the OLA report pointed out that an audit trail has not been essentially established. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Nash.
If I read the initial bill correctly, Representative Scott, that was created at the day of final passage, that an audit trail was supposed to be included. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I guess, Representative Scott, what happened? If you could maybe elaborate, because the OLA is not here. I'm just really curious as to how we got here, because from my perspective, working in IT, if you deploy a system and you're required to have something like an audit trail included, it should have been built into it from day one, and there are a good number of software packages that deal with customer service and things like that that do leave an audit trail, and I'm just curious as to how this happened.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. I believe someone is here from the Office of the Legislative Auditor that could maybe speak to this, and I'm not exactly sure how it happened, how it didn't happen, actually, how the audit trail didn't happen. I do know that in the department's response to the OLA's report, they did give some timelines as to when they thought that this would be in place, and if someone is here from the agencies, maybe they can speak to that.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, as they're coming up to the podium, one of the questions I would also like to get asked is, what's currently being done today? Is there anything being left in the records from an audit perspective? Has that been enacted? Where are we on that?
Chair Scott.
And I would think, thank you, Mr. Chair, I would think that would be a question for the department, too. But I believe you're from the Legislative Auditor's Office.
Yeah. Good morning and welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Good morning. I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor. And I'm probably not the best person to talk about the technical IT aspects of what's done or not. What we found last year was that there was not a sufficient verification between the data that came out of MNSURE and the data that went into DHS's files, and also that there were too many people with access to that data during the transfer process. This year we did actually do an update of that review since the 2014 report came out. And in a report that we issued in 2016 in January, we found that those conditions had not really changed, that there perhaps had been some enhancement in the reconciliation process between what came out of MNSURE and what goes into DHS, but did not feel that it was that those enhancements were sufficient to resolve the problems. And we also felt that there continued to be a significant enough number of people with no logging of what they were accessing during that transfer process of, did they open the files, did they look at the files, did they copy the files, did they delete files, did they change files, that was not being sufficiently logged, or was not being logged, and ideally those kinds of actions would be logged and then reviewed by someone outside of the process to make sure that any of those changes that occurred in the file transfer process were authorized and appropriate and done accurately. So we did continue to see that. We also, based on a sample test that we did, found inconsistencies in information related to people that had their eligibility initially determined through MNsure, and as that information came into DHS and got into the state's medical payment system, MMIS, we found inconsistencies in those files where perhaps in MNsure it said that the person was eligible for Minnesota Care, but when we looked at that same person in MMIS, we found that they were enrolled in medical assistance. So we saw these inconsistencies in the data. We can't directly say that those inconsistencies are a result of something that happened during the data transfer process, but knowing that there are also weaknesses in that process and that the actions of employees with access to the data is not being logged and reviewed, there certainly is a chance, a risk, that that's where some inconsistencies are arising from.
Thank you, Ms. Ferkel. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ferkel, question for you. From an auditor's perspective, it sounds like there's really a lack of best practices being utilized, and as a legislator, that really concerns me deeply that we're not following best practices standards that are established across the nation for such a thing as this. And it seems, if you could just firm up for me again, that this has not been being done from inception and that we're still not following best practices. We really have no idea who is accessing the data, who's doing what with the data, and as part of the audit trail or part of what they're currently doing, do we know if the data that has been accessed has been perhaps copied and utilized in other venues? Do we know any of that?
Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair, we don't see the logs that would tell us that kind of specific information. And also, I do want to pull back just a little bit. Our work was done 9 months to a year ago. There may be changes in the department, and it might be helpful to have someone from DHS or Minute IT to address or answer what has happened in the meantime and what the current state is right now. I agree that our criteria when we looked at this was best practices, is best practices for what we would expect to see. And I would just say, personally, especially in data transfers that involve so much information about so many Minnesotans and so much non-public information, that as a citizen of the state, I would expect to see best practices in place.
Okay. Mr. Chair, last follow-up.
Thank you, Ms. Ferkel. Representative Nash, your last follow-up.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question is, somewhere along your investigation, did you find that a decision had been made to not implement this logging system and to create the ability to have an audit trail? Were there documents that you found that said, we just can't get this implemented, we don't have the resource? I'm just wondering, it was put into statute early on, we know that, and it has not been enacted. What was the decision-making tree that got us to that point?
Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't recall that we had any documentation that showed a management decision to not implement these controls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Scott, looks like we are in a new year from last year. It looks like you have an A1 amendment. Is that correct to make this 2016, or is that another member's amendment? Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, this is an A1 amendment that just updates the effective date from 2015 to 2016.
I'd like to move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott moves the A1 amendment. Any questions or discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Scott or members, any final discussion to House File 1109 as amended? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I saw somebody here from MNsure or Minute that wanted to come down and testify, answer the question, the earlier question from Mr. Representative Nash.
I have not heard. Is there someone here from MNsure or Minute?
There was somebody here on the off to my side that was looking to get on. So I mean, if they want to come down and testify.
Sure. Morning, sir. If you would introduce yourself for the record and briefly state your comments.
Mr. Chair, my name is Scott Peterson. I'm the CIO for DHS and Minsher. Mr. Chair, just to respond to the questions from Representative Nash a bit, the implementation in House File 5 and the ACA actually requires the audit trail within the Minsher MET system, as it's being called now. That implementation was completed and in the core system, so the functionality of eligibility, the plan selection, as well as the financials piece of that. The functionality that was implemented at the time was done based by product, so based on the product sets that were chosen, whether it was Curum or Connecture or the EngagePoint products. And there's currently a project underway to deliver a solution that's more comprehensive, that includes a single view into that versus kind of a piecemeal approach to it.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Peterson, question for you then, because I just heard the OLA say that there wasn't an audit trail, and you're saying that there was an audit trail, and I heard you call Minsher a different name, so maybe you could elucidate on that, because that's new. But I'm primarily interested in, it seems that your comment and the OLA is incongruous with one another. You're saying that there has been an audit trail, and yet they haven't been able to find one.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, the audit trail I'm speaking of is in the core MET system. I think the OLA finding responds directly to the interface to MMIS and the work that's done in the claim system, which is outside of Minsher or METS. And the METS system, the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System, as it's being called today by both department and Minsher internally. So just that's the explanation on that.
Representative Nash.
I guess, I mean, we could belabor this point a lot. I would love to get more answers as to, you know, what we've heard from one, and now you're telling us that there has been, and I'm just still confused. So would love to have you and Chair Scott and perhaps the OLA come to my office and help me understand, because from an IT person's perspective, this just doesn't make sense that you're claiming had audit trails and now suddenly we don't. So I'm just confused.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I'm not saying that the interface to MMIS had audit trails at the time. I'm saying the core MET solution, which is what House File 5 and the ACA refer to, was built into the original solution.
Thank you. Any other discussion to House File 1109 as amended? Seeing none. With that, Representative Scott renews her motion that House File 1109 be referred to the General Register as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and House File 1109 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Scott. Members, next on the agenda is House File 644, Representative Zerwas. And as he is making his way down, Vice Chair Pugh, if we could have you review the minutes and make a motion on them from April 22nd, 2015.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have reviewed the minutes, and I move the minutes from April 22nd.
Members, any discussion to the members from April 22nd, 2015? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion to approve the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted from April 22nd, 2015.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 644 be brought before the committee and that it be moved to civil law.
Representative Pugh moves House File 644 to be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. With that, Representative Zerwas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always have fun in GovOps. House File 644, the Massage and Bodywork Therapy Act. This legislation creates a voluntary registration process for massage and bodywork therapists. This bill represents really decades of work and compromise over the years between different groups of massage and bodywork therapists across the state. It's a compromise between those therapists who at one point wanted licensure and those that believe the current system of kind of patchwork authorization city by city is okay. Currently, the occupation of massage and bodywork therapists is regulated under 146A, the Complementary and Alternative Healthcare Practice Act, and really a set of city ordinances from city to city to city. Some cities also regulate business establishment licensure. And so there's a differentiation we have to make between occupational licensure and business establishment licensure. This bill focuses solely on occupational licensure. And the gist of the bill, if you can imagine an employee that is doing massage and body work in Maple Grove, and they work, you know, maybe 30 or 40 hours a week in Maple Grove, but the person that also owns that establishment owns an establishment in the city of Rogers or in the city of Blaine, and they have a Saturday off once a month where they could pick up an extra shift in Rogers or Blaine. And right now, under current law, in order to do that, they would have to go to that new city, submit their credentials, that proving their education, submit to a criminal background check, and go through the city of Rogers process, pay the fine or pay the fee, and do all of that. And then if they want to work in their, if that business owner also wanted them to work in their massage establishment in the city of Blaine, they would have to go to the city of Blaine, file a new application for a licensure through the city of Blaine, submit to another criminal background check, and pay another fee. And so what we're doing is we're creating a voluntary registry that would be statewide, so that if you wanted to work in multiple jurisdictions, you could simply apply once, pay the fee once, prove your education, and that you can pass a criminal background check once per year, and then be able to take that registration requirement and practice in multiple locations. With the establishment of some franchise type massage spots like Massage Envy and others, there's a need for this as people are working in more than one city quite frequently, or would like to work in more than one city frequently. This bill will not require anyone to participate. If you work in the city of St. Michael and want to keep working in the city of St. Michael and don't want to work anywhere else besides the city of St. Michael, you can continue to work with your city to follow their requirements and keep doing massages to your heart's content. And so I think it's really important to point that out. I have a few testifiers. I have a testifier from the city of Blaine who just worked through some massage ordinances in the city of Blaine. And then I also have the Burnsville police chief that would talk a little bit more broadly about why criminal background checks are important for this type of work.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I also see the A2 amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
The A2 amendment is an author's amendment.
If it's okay with you, I'll have Representative Pugh move that so we can get the bill in the shape that you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would like to move the A2, which amends House File 644. So right. Representative Zerwas.
Members, these are date changes. Is there any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A2 to put the bill in the shape the author wishes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. With that, Representative Zerwas, why don't you go ahead and call up your first testifier.
Yep. You want to come up here?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Committee members, my name is Kathy Sorensen, City Clerk for the City of Blaine. As clerk of one of Anoka County's two largest cities, and on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, I'm here in support of House File 644. Establishing a statewide registration system for massage and body work would greatly assist cities and local law enforcement agencies in preventing individuals from conducting criminal activities such as prostitution for establishments operating as massage therapy facilities. Minnesota is one of only five states in the nation that does not regulate massage and bodywork therapy. And with the absence of any type of statewide registration, cities have had to respond to this ever-growing healthcare activity by enacting local ordinances requiring massage therapists to obtain local licensure. While these ordinances help law officials differentiate between legitimate providers and others that may be fronting as prostitution, local licensing comes at a cost. To the therapist, the business owners, and to the public. Costly background and compliance checks, especially if they have to be licensed in more than one municipality, burden on already stressed police resources, inspections of a healthcare activity by non-healthcare professionals like ourselves, lack of minimum and continuing education requirements, and lack of funding for limited recourse should a concern or complaint come along. Blaine enacted this ordinance in 2012 in response to increased interest by business owners. Blaine is always excited to promote growth and success of small businesses and certainly does not want to keep individuals from entering this field. But because of the lack of statewide registration, we had to focus on consumer safety and crime prevention. The need to balance protection for the public while attracting and retaining successful businesses comes at a cost. Again, background investigations, verification of accredited education, photo ID badges to make sure that the staff are the ones that are actually licensed, all comes at a cost. Enactment of 644 would help establish legitimacy of providers, assist with prevention of criminal activities, improve provider compliance, and further protect the public. Thanks for the opportunity, and I'm available to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Sorensen. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one of you, why are you using the Board of Nursing instead of Health?
Representative Ross.
So the language as it stands now would have the Board of Nursing do the management of this, and that's just the way it's drafted. If you have better suggestions, I'll work. I'd be interested in working with you on that. This is how it's been drafted the last several years. It's working up through the Board of Nursing. We'll have a subsect, but ultimately reporting to the Board of Nursing rather than creating a separate board that we'd have to fund for just massage and body work.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, I thought maybe Department of Health would be a natural fit.
I don't know if there's anyone from the department here.
Duly noted. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Thank you, Ms. Sorensen, for your testimony.
Chief.
Morning, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Eric Gieske. I'm the Chief of Police of the City of Burnsville. I'm also a co-chair with the Minnesota Chiefs Association on the legislative committee. So from my perspective, I do support 644, and I do think it's important that we have some type of oversight and consistency in the licensing. From a law enforcement perspective, one of the things that we've experienced in Burnsville is that we have a large number of very legitimate and professional establishments, but over the past several years, we've noticed an increase and businesses that I would say aren't necessarily legitimate. And a lot of those complaints come from our citizens, and we've investigated at least 7 or 8 of those in the past couple of years and discovered that there is, in fact, criminal activity in these places and that it is creating some issues and concern in our community. So I support what Representative Zeroas is proposing and trying to get some oversight in this piece. And also on the front end of it, it's very difficult for us, and I've heard this from our investigators, to verify some of the credentials when they're doing the background. When these come to our department, it's hard to determine if it's coming from a diploma mill or if it's a legitimate establishment. It's very time consuming. So to be able to have that done before they come to the city would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Chief.
Welcome.
Any final comments? I mean, good job.
Any questions?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either Representative Zuros or to the Chief. I note in your letter that you've provided to us in the second paragraph that you describe a legitimate state license, but yet, as I understand from hearing the testimony of the author, that we're really talking about a credentialing and a voluntary registration format. So for the purposes of everyone in the audience as well as for the committee, I'm wondering if we could have clarity in terms of what legitimately we are asking for here.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. I think that's really important for transparency and just so everyone knows what page we're on. This is a voluntary registration bill. This is not a licensure bill. The difficulty, I think, and the confusion with our friends with the League of Minnesota Cities and other municipal partners, currently cities are issuing city massage licenses. And so when they talk about the process that they go through for licensure, they're talking about the city licensure process that they're already engaged in practicing in. This bill would set up a voluntary registration that would allow an individual that registers statewide through the voluntary registration, pays one fee, proves to one entity that they have passed the educational requirements and have passed them, and then submit for a background check. They will get something from the registry that then they could turn in to the city of Burnsville for the city of Burnsville's process that would absolve the city of Burnsville from having to do their process. So Chief Geiske's officers would not have to do a separate criminal background check and try to figure out if this massage school diploma is legitimate or not.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make clarity on the distinction between the municipalities are not abdicating their responsibility to provide an opportunity for a business to exist in their municipality. That's still their domain and germane to their responsibilities to license the business. But the individual is what this legislation really approaches for the purposes of informing the public as well as the municipalities.
Representative Ross.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright keyed on the important point is the League of Minnesota Cities, one of the reasons they are supportive of this bill is for cities that have a business license, you can still license the business, the brick mortar business, an operation of a massage shop in a business. You do not, they will be, if someone is on the registry, the city will not have the ability to look at the individual, and that is something that the cities are glad to move beyond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chief. Woodbury worked really hard on with hiring the standards for the licensure because we had a problem with sex trafficking in our area. And they had similar language to 7.17, any misdemeanor felony conviction. And then one thing they found out while conducting their background checks on applicants were that there were instances where an applicant was charged with the crime but entered into a plea agreement, providing for the continuance of the charge or for dismissal or other disposition. Essentially, the bottom line is what they found were there were instances where serious crimes were charged, but they were unable to deny licensure because of the way the case was resolved. So would you be open to maybe some additional language to work around that, Representative Zerwas?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, we've worked extensively with the League and with the Chiefs Association, but I am very open that we put together language that's as comprehensive as possible, because certainly our intent is not to do something that would allow any type of that activity to continue.
Chief, did you have any follow-up?
Nope, I support that. It makes absolutely good sense to me.
Representative Fenton.
Representative Zerwas, I do have the language that Woodbury included. I would love to share that with you if you'd want to entertain that. But I have one more question. Even though the registration is voluntary, would the city of Woodbury and other cities be able to further regulate under their own ordinances?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, the city of Woodbury or any city would not be able to further regulate the requirements, as I understand it, the requirements of the registered and approved masseuse. They would be able to have whatever their business licensure component is to regulate the business operation of a massage and body work shop.
Okay, and I've got one.
Representative Fenton.
And just one more question, as I've had a lot of conversations with my city leaders. If registration is prohibited, would an applicant be able to apply, like, say, after 5 years has passed, if since they're disqualifying event or conviction?
Representative Zerwas.
I believe there is. I will double check, but I'm pretty sure there's an appeals process and period. But I'll double check.
And that'll be a good question to discuss in civil law at the next committee as well.
Okay.
So thank you, Representative Fenton. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No further questions.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one, I mean, these sort of licensing laws that we established always fence some people out, and that's a big concern. I don't know if, you know, if that's worthy to talk about. I don't know. But somebody could conceivably, I see, come with just a background and experience in massage therapy. So they don't have to have supervised classroom at this point, right?
In
Representative Zerwas.
In the grandfather portion of the bill, correct.
Okay.
Representative
And how long does the grandfathering condition exist? I mean, is that something that will disappear then after the initial registration period?
Representative Zerwas.
Okay.
Yes, it's a time period, and then they would have to, when they apply for renewal, I believe it's 5 years. When they apply for renewal, they have to show one of the other non-grandfathered ways to be registered. So the hours and the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Will there be, Mr. Chair,
Representative Runbeck.
Representative Zerwas, will there be any claims that somehow the coursework will be expensive? I mean, where will this be happening? And what kind of cost is incurred? Again, if somebody's saying, I'm just going to do this part-time.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, just so we're clear, the grandfathering piece is effective for 2 years, not 5 years, just to be clear. I found it in the bill, it's 2 years. And yes, that is one of the concerns, is what does future coursework potentially look like. That's one of the things we're continuing to work with to make sure that's not a deterrent. But to understand that I don't look at this as a fencing bill that fences people out. That's current. That's current law, where if you want to cross the Mississippi River from Elk River to Otsego, you need to reapply, you need to get relicensed, you need to repass a background check. Whereas if you were registered in a statewide registry and you wanted to go half a block across the river to the massage shop in Otsego, that would already be covered. So while there's an argument that says that some licensure bills create fences and it's a fencing for occupational licensing, with a statewide volunteer registry, this is, if you would like to participate in the registry because you're going to practice in multiple jurisdictions, that you can do it once and you can apply once and you can pay once and you can practice unlimited. I think that's the bulk of it and the plus of it. If you wouldn't meet, even after the grandfathered period, if you wouldn't meet the educational requirements or you don't intend on practicing in multiple cities, or you don't want to pay multiple cities for licensure, municipal licensure, then you could absolutely stay with the current system.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Chief, for your testimony. I have two final testifiers on my list, Catherine Bergen and Barb York. Are they in the audience today? If you would, make your way down to the testifiers table. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your comments. And again, members, just so everyone understands, they come down. In general, our committee has jurisdiction over rulemaking, advisory council, and the effects on municipal ordinances. This bill is going to civil law and most likely health finance as well. So some of the surrounding issues will be issues that will be dealt with in other committees.
Hello. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'm Catherine Berg, and I am representing an organization called the Minnesota Integrative Care Advocates, and we have been here at the legislature advocating for natural health laws for since 1998. I'm a resident of Woodbury. In fact, I am Representative Fenton's constituent. And I am here to oppose HF 644, a bill to voluntarily register massage therapists. And I just want to kind of go through point by point. There is a handout. It's the colorful one. And I have a few things that I will add. First of all, they say that the bill is only voluntary and it is only registration. So I would like to just say that any local unit of government could and likely will require compliance with the provisions in order to get a business license. And so all of a sudden, it is not voluntary, it is mandatory. So the idea that this is voluntary is not necessarily a realistic outcome of passing this bill. And I was involved when the city of Woodbury passed their massage therapy licensure, and I will tell you that there was at least one person who was no longer able to practice in Woodbury because the school she had attended had closed. And so she actually had to go back to school so that she could practice in Woodbury. And she was also only spoke Chinese, and so it was really hard for her to find a school that she could go back to study with. There was not one in Minnesota. So there is a history of this happening with these city licensures and any kind of licensure like that. I think it's also potentially confusing for the police departments. How will they know who's following the city ordinance and who's following the registry when they knock on the door if there's a complaint? The proponents also say it will resolve this crazy quilt of regulations that by the cities that abounds, forcing many practitioners to have to possess multiple licenses. And I have a couple of questions that I really would like answered on this. And first of all, how many people does this really affect? Is it two? Is it 20? Is it 200? We have no idea how many people this affects. Are we just passing a bill for a couple of large companies that this might affect, where it might have a negative effect on a whole lot of practitioners? It's $50 to practice in Woodbury. If they do this, it's over 200. You know, that's a lot more difference, or a lot of difference, and it might not be helping very many people at all. Another fact about this crazy quilt of local licensing is that it is largely the proponents' own making. For 30 years, they have been going around from city to city trying to create these ordinances in order to ultimately force a statewide licensure. And this has been the pattern in all the other states. And the reason that we do not have a statewide licensure in Minnesota is that we have Minnesota Statute 146A, which does regulate. And Minnesota's Statute 146 does allow investigation, and so does Minnesota Statute 609. We have all the laws we need to do the investigating, and we could even offer an amendment which would simply allow local police to enforce 146A in situations like this. And that's all it would take. And then we wouldn't have to have all of these other patchwork of city licenses. But I will tell you that in 2010, a discussion with the city attorneys and the League of Minnesota Cities revealed that many city attorneys don't actually trust the state to properly screen and enforce the laws which they initially implemented to prevent prostitution from occurring within city limits. And the history in Minnesota and other states shows that licensing massage therapists doesn't prevent it. Minnesota has, within the Department of Health, an Office of Complementary and Alternative Practices. And when they get a complaint, they investigate, and if their investigation shows that this is not a massage therapy business, but in fact is somebody who is a prostitute, they will actually shut them down. They will get charged with prostitution, and they will not be allowed to engage in any practice that is covered by 146A for the rest of their lives. So we really already have great laws in place in Minnesota. Minnesota was the first state in the country to have a law like this, and there are maybe 7 or 8 other states now, and more states are trying to get laws like this passed. Let me see if there's anything else here. So in summary, if this bill becomes law, it has the potential actually to cause more problems than currently exist, and may solve problems for only a handful of business owners. It may cause double regulations when cities decide to follow the lead of Minneapolis and create a business license rather than a massage therapy license. So now all of a sudden they have to pay twice. It may become mandatory when cities decide to require their massage therapists to register. The cities don't trust the state to do the investigations. And there are already there are many laws in place already. This one isn't necessary. And we don't know how many people actually have to buy licenses in multiple cities. Nobody has ever been able to answer that question for us. I would appreciate it if someone would ask that question. So this is a bill, is a classic case of a solution looking for a problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berg, for your testimony. And if you would, introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Barbara York. I am the president of the Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network. You have a copy of our history here. You can see that we've been dealing with this issue for over 30 years. We worked with the cities until we realized that we were not fighting prostitution laws. We were actually saying, please enforce them to the full extent of the law. And so we stopped fighting cities and have looked for ways to support that. And that's what we finally came to after years of working with the city of Minneapolis, is a simple business license which will not go away with any kind of regulation, further regulation. I have to say that because in the proponents list on their face page their disdain for the law that we already have in place. They refuse to refer to it as regulation. They refer to the state as being unregulated, which undercuts the consumers of this state when they do that kind of promotion. And so that's a type of scoffing that we find very disturbing, especially when you look at the list of the people who are presenting this bill are essentially national organizations that are insurance carriers for the profession, schools, local schools, and some of the big franchises like Massage Envy. They just have a disdain because it does not create a filter that works for them, but not for the citizens. This is what we recognized when we passed the 146A, that the major harm to the consumer was abuse of power. And we passed the bill that says this is the client's bills of rights, this is the conduct, these are the penalties. For those who go further and sexually abuse clients, we passed the 609, which says you're a criminal, you go to jail, you have punishments, and you come out a registered sex offender. Neither of those bills were supported by the people here promoting this bill. You'll see it from the, there's a letter addressed to Mr. Suarez, Representative Suarez, from the Advocates for Human Rights, who wrote the book for you in 2008 on sex trafficking in Minnesota. We have been working with them since that time, before the city of Minneapolis, as a matter of fact. And what we found is that regulations like this don't help them. What passed in Minneapolis helps them, not only because it allows the police to go to the door, knock, and enter And when you have trafficking, you don't have time to go and get a warrant. You have to be able to enter. The city needs that. When you take that away from them, you create a problem. And therefore, they're not going to let go of that. If they have an occupational license, they will convert it to a business license, or, as Catherine pointed out, they will make it mandatory that you have this registration. The city of Minneapolis set up their law so that, in keeping with trafficking issues, they see the prostituted person as a victim. We have been working across the country as well as in this state to look at trafficking as an entirely different issue than what we generally grew up with, was the concern about prostitution. Trafficking is far more evil and far more clever and has the money to do it. You'll see further in this letter that recently they found in 2013 a case in Florida where 80 women, 161 licenses suspended by the health department. This is on page 2 of 3 of that letter. Those women were licensed in the state of Florida. They were trafficked women, and their papers had been purchased through an employee at a school because of money. They have lots and lots of money. This will fence people out. There are practitioners who are part-time who will not be able to afford this registration. Most people work in a stationary place like their home or their place of business. The people who travel are very small in this industry. They usually have either a brick and mortar or they're working out of their home, which I have done since 1983. I cannot afford, really, both of these. I do not want to meet some of the requirements of this registration. My doctor clients do not do CPR in their own clinics. They call 911. To have a massage therapist occasionally have to do, and in my time, I've never had to do CPR. I taught CPR when it first came out. I would not do it unless I was regularly doing it. This is all padded up, but I'll tell you, over all the years, the thing that never goes away out of these registration bills is educational factors, because that's where the money is in this, and the continuing education. I have thousands of hours of continuing education. I don't need to have continuing education. My clients are satisfied. We license restaurants to contain their food in proper conditions because that's a danger. But you can go and get a bad egg in a lot of places, and you can spend a lot of money for a good egg or a bad egg. But the 214, specifically our state statute, which we studied in 214, the criteria for regulation, whether the unregulated practice, subdivision 2, item 1, whether the unregulated practice of an occupation may harm or endanger the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of the state, and whether the potential for harm is recognizable and not remote. We covered that. It's covered under our regulation. That there is nothing here from the Attorney General saying that we must do something. The citizens rose up and passed the 146A. We're covered. You don't need to spend your time and future money, let alone today's money, pursuing something else. It has not risen to that need. You'll notice there's also an article from last year how well the massage ordinance in Minneapolis worked in shutting down trafficking. We have it all. We have long been working at this, and the facts show that we are already an effective state in the massage profession.
Thank you, Ms. York, for your testimony. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Chair Sanders. Just could you or council point to what sections are actually under our purview in this committee? I just want to have a refresher.
I have it here, but Mr. Shepherd, would you like an opportunity to speak? I know you thrive on that.
Mr. Chair and members, the reason why the bill would have been a mandatory re-referral to this committee under House rules is on lines 4.18 and 5.3, which deals with rulemaking. Then on page 5, section 7 creates an advisory council. There are other things that the committee and the witnesses have been discussing that relate to municipal regulation and preemption that are probably may well be within the committee's jurisdiction as well.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned it would go to HHS finance. Why wouldn't it go to HHS policy? It seems to affect policy.
Representative Mallory, it may very well. I'll let Representative Zeroas answer, but I know that the next stop is civil law. Representative Zeroas.
Mr. Chair, members, last year this bill was heard and was passed out of HHS reform. It was re-referred to this committee. We ran out of time, and so we're picking up here in hopes of making 3 or 4 committee stops in 10 weeks. So wish me luck.
Thank you. Any other member questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Pugh renews her motion that House File 644 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 644 is on its way to civil law.
Thank you.
Thank you. For that, next bill on the agenda is House File 1282, Chair Knobloch's bill. And for that, Representative Pugh has a motion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move Representative Knobloch's bill, House File 1282, for consideration and possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Pugh moves House File 1282 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Chair Knobloch, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House File 1282, it is one simple thing. It changes the law so that state legislative candidates run for office without a political party listed next to their name on the ballot. State legislative candidates would run for office just like most mayors, county commissioners, school board members, and city councilors without a political party being listed next to their name on the ballot. Minnesota state legislative elections were actually run this way from 1911 to the mid-1970s. Minnesota is one of two states, the other state being Nebraska, that have a long experience in the 20th century of nonpartisan legislative elections, and Nebraska still does their elections this way today. Why do I suggest this? First, I believe that excessive partisanship sometimes gets in the way of accomplishing things. I sometimes see ideas on one side seemingly rejected by the other side just because of where they came from. And I sometimes see ideas from one side that are probably not given the scrutiny they deserve by that same side because the idea did come from, quote, our side. Second, I believe it would curb the power of special interests because they would have to convince more people to accomplish their will. Third, I believe it would reduce the negativity of campaigns. You generally don't see the sort of negativity in local races like mayoral races, city council races, that you see in state legislative races. While there would still be spirited campaigns, I think they would be less negative, encouraging more good people to run. And finally, I think it might reduce the amount of campaign spending. And as an example, in my seat in 2014, 14B was the highest spending state House race in history, and that year with a total of $972,000 spent between my campaign, my opponent's campaign, but particularly the other special interests on both sides. If you look at Nebraska, whose districts are almost identical to our House districts, the highest spending race in that state in 2014 was $431,000, less than half the amount of our highest spending race. It is natural for any of you who have only known our current partisan system to ask, how could this work? How would the legislature be organized? Who would choose the committee chairs? First, of course, it did work for over 60 years, so it can work. But regarding legislative organization, you should know that Minnesota had no majority and minority caucuses right after 1911. Decades later, they organized into what were called conservative and liberal caucuses. But historically, there were a number of primarily rural Democrats that caucused with the conservatives and a number of primarily metro Republicans that caucused with the liberals. Conservatives and liberals were just not other words for Democrats and Republicans. Nebraska today, on the other hand, has three caucuses and has had three caucuses for many decades. And those three caucuses represent each of their three congressional districts. Regarding committee chairs, Nebraska legislators elect their committee chairs instead of having them appointed by a leader. Historically, it is not unusual for a committee chair from what would be considered the minority to be elected based on their expertise, seniority, and reputation for fairness. And while the fiscal note does not show any cost or savings to this bill, I believe there could be some savings because we would not need, for example, separate partisan research staffs, but could instead just rely on nonpartisan research. In closing, I would refer you to the foreword of the book, The Minnesota Legislature of 1919, that I've had a copy of the foreword distributed by. And if you look in the back, you can see the author make the comment. In 1911, the legislature was made nonpartisan. Since then, the party boss and party caucus have been less in evidence. Members have been more free to use their individual judgment. Whether or not this has been an improvement depends largely on the intelligence of the individual member. An ignorant or dishonest member may be held in line by a caucus for either good or bad. An honest, intelligent member is better off without a party boss or a caucus, and it is safe to say that the nonpartisan election has resulted in a better and more independent group of men coming to the legislature. This is, of course, before women's suffrage. It is not generally true, as some have charged, that more self-seekers have come to the front. Just the opposite. There has been a different sort of cooperation among the voters and a better sort. Less party, more principle. Members, I urge your support for this historic bill.
Thank you, Chair Knobloch. With that, members, any questions or comments? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, I always love to talk history. Thank you for bringing a nice historical document. You're actually bringing forth an issue that is much older than the state of Minnesota. This writings on this date back to passage of our own U.S. Constitution. And in the Federalist 10, James Madison lamented the issue of factions, and there was actually some discussion about how do you outlaw political parties. Madison, in his wisdom, decided you can't actually outlaw political parties. It's not possible. But what you can do is put pressure on the outcome of partisanship. And we do that and can do that through our laws. And your issue, raising the issue of campaign finance, is really important. And I appreciate that you are interested in having more issue-based campaigns and less dogmatic-based campaigns, I guess you could say. And but I don't necessarily see how this could do that, because most of the spending in our race, is certainly in my race, was from organizations outside political parties. And so we've taken the notion of factions as a political party, and actually our laws have expanded upon them and made those outside forces even more powerful than our political parties, because these outside forces don't have to follow the same reporting requirements that our political parties and our candidates have to. And in fact, it's in our state constitution that our political parties and our candidates have to follow certain laws when it comes to campaign spending and campaign disclosure. And we don't put that on those outside organizations. So I'd say we kind of flipped the Federalist 10 on its head and have managed through our laws to expand the power of the factions instead of making sure that the people end up having the biggest voice in our elections. And so I appreciate this. My grandfather was actually a state senator.
as a member of the Conservative Caucus for many, many years. And there was also never any question which side he landed on. In fact, physically, they even organized themselves like we do today. The Conservative Caucus sitting on the right, the Liberal Caucus sitting on the left. And so how much this would change in practice, I think, would be limited. I certainly appreciate the idea. And we do like to think about the days when we were more congenial in our campaigns. His campaign flyers only would say that he was honest and had integrity, and bless him, it didn't talk about partisanship and it didn't talk about issues. But we have gone far beyond that with the amount of spending in our campaigns. And I think as a legislature, where we can have the biggest issue or the biggest impact on this type of partisanship that really is leaving the people out is to do as Madison said, and manage the outcome, manage the impact of that partisanship by passing laws that will make outside organizations have to be accountable to the people by making them disclose.
Chair Knobloch, any comments?
I guess I would just say, first of all, thank you for raising the Federalist Papers. I thought about mentioning that too, and you're right. Madison does warn about factions. I guess I would say this is not a cure-all, but I think that it would make a positive difference. I think we have examples from our past. I think we have examples from the other state that does this today. And I do think that many of the things you're talking about in terms of the campaign spending were somewhat restricted on because of U.S. Supreme Court decisions anyway.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. And while I think this there's laudable goals that this bill brings forward, I don't, as was said earlier, I don't think it's going to change what's going on in our country and what's going on. I don't see it as being a cure-all for that. And the bill itself, I don't think, goes far enough in correcting within law some of the issues that would come up if just this was passed. It's been brought to my attention about the campaign finance laws, the public subsidy laws that are part of that, that it would make it difficult for those laws to be enforced without political parties because they mentioned Republicans and Democrats all the way through them. So if we're going to go do this, I think we have to go much farther than this with just this simple page and a half bill that we have in front of us. With that, I mean, Mr. Chair, I've got two amendments, and the one, the A2 amendment, is more for amusement for everybody here in the. So I'm not going to offer that amendment, but I think it's for everybody's amusement and whatever. But the A1 amendment I'd like to offer, Mr. Chair, and part of this goes at currently in law we have a statute 211B that 06 that makes it a gross misdemeanor to distribute false claims, and now that is currently in the Supreme Court and has been declared unconstitutional in other states. And right now the Office of Administrative Hearings would like to get rid of that law off our books because they can't enforce it. And I guess, but currently right now, if people come in, if Representative Knobloch's opponent puts a false statement and somebody from Representative Knobloch's committee or supporter would go down and file a complaint under that law, the Office of Administrative Hearings takes their money, registers it, and says, we can't enforce the law anyway, so basically they're wasting a lot of their time and costing individual taxpayers money because they've got to file to get this done. So I would like to amend this to put this piece in here about false political campaigns and into the law, to get rid of that law and to tweak that so that make it would make it constitutional. And so that's my amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the A1 on House File 1282. Chair Knobloch, any comments?
Well, I would first say, just so members know, in reference to the A2 amendment, I introduced this bill early last year, and I actually introduced this bill originally in 1999 when I was in my previous stint in this body. So it far predates any other political activities today. But in regard to the A1 amendment, I don't have a problem with the A1 amendment. I do think it goes to the wrong section because, as you referenced, while I'm not eliminating partisan races at, say, the governor level, the state constitutional office level, so there'd still be public subsidies there. There would be a question as to whether there'd be public subsidies for these races, and so I don't know that this really applies. But I appreciate the spirit you're bringing it in, and I would urge people to vote for the A1 amendment.
Any other member questions or comments on the A1? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A1 is adopted. Any other member questions or discussion? House File 1282 as amended. Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Knobloch, you indicated that in 1999 you had offered this. Were you anticipating a Y2K problem and this is going to be your prevent at that point?
No, sir, but I just, Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, I have believed in this for a long time, and while I would not say it is a cure-all, I really think it would make a difference. It made a difference before. If you look at the historical record, it's making a difference in the other state that uses it now. I think this is not, you know, we elect all sorts of other local governments underneath this same system. I think it would work well for us.
Any final questions or discussion? Seeing none, with that, Representative Pugh renews her motion that House File 1282 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill as amended. Thank you, Chair Knobloch, for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next on the list, House File 1365, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might note there's nothing like standing between all of you and lunch. So.
Treats. Treats.
Go ahead, Representative Fenton. You can move House File 1365.
I move House File 1365 to be referred to the General Registry.
Representative Fenton moves House File 1365 to be referred to the General Register. Again, members, this bill was in our committee and passed out of our committee last year. And under Rule 4.20, we are back to re-refer this committee to the General Register. With that, Representative Fenton, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment.
Representative Fenton moves the A11 to put the bill in the shape that the author desires.
So, members, the A11 amendment just changes, deletes page 6, line 23, deletes 2016, and inserts the date of 2018.
Members, any discussion to having an effective date of 2018? Seeing none, all in favor of the author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Fenton, to your bill as amended.
So, members, we've already heard this bill. We had comments from Secretary Simon, and so I just move that the bill be moved. House File 1365 be moved to the General Registry.
Any other member questions or discussion? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this is just standard practice, and I support the motion to move it back to the General.
With that, Representative Fenton renews her motion that House File 1365 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The bill is referred to the General Register as amended.
Quick Thank hammer you. There, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, no kidding. Representative Fenton, you are next. Bill in front of us, House File 2774.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2774 be referred to Public Safety.
Representative Fenton moves that House File 2774 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, and first of all, I'd like to thank Representative Nelson for also being a co-author of this bill. This relates to emergency election planning task force. Over the interim, there were two submitted bills to the legislature for consideration by this task force, and I'm going to turn over for comment from our Secretary Simon, who led this task force, and to discuss how we came to this conclusion. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary. Always a pleasure to have you with us in this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Great to be with you on your first day. Representative Anderson, welcome again. It was great to meet with you last week in your office. Welcome to the legislature, and welcome members back. As Representative Fenton said, the two bills here before you, 2774 and the next one, 2775, are the result of what you created last year, which was the Elections Emergency Planning Task Force, which consisted of 14 members, including folks from county, city, and township government, as well as members of the legislature, including Representatives Fenton and Nelson, one from each of the four legislative caucus, and emergency planning experts from multiple layers of government, not just one. We had state emergency planning folks, we had folks from the National Guard, we had folks from city, from municipal emergency management as well, who were not elections experts. They were just there to counsel us in terms of emergency management in general. So it was quite a diverse group. And really, what this all grew out of, as you all recognized last year when you passed this, a lot of the recent reason for this came about because of Hurricane Sandy in 2012. Some of you remember that hit New York and New Jersey a few days before a presidential election in 2012, and it left a lot of folks scrambling and wondering, well, what authority really is there in those states? Can they postpone an election? Should they? Can they move a polling place? And that, in turn, got other states around the country looking at their own law books to determine what was on the books, if anything, to provide guidance for state and local elections officials. And the answer in most states, including Minnesota, is really not very much at all. So although it's a remote possibility, and although obviously we're not going to have a hurricane anytime soon, there are weather emergencies, Halloween snowstorms, God forbid a public health outbreak or something of the sort, and we just have to be prepared, even though it's a remote possibility. So we're well equipped generally to deal with things in Minnesota in our election system, but this is one where there's precious little guidance. We met over a six-month period. We met roughly monthly, I would say, and we got a lot of testimony, not only from the folks on the committee or on the commission, but from folks outside of the commission, the National Association of Secretaries of State, the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington, D.C., Representative of Minnesota's Adjutant General Office, the State Emergency Manager, and on and on. And so I think it's fair to say that we tried to figure out what the sweet spot would be between sort of command and control, know-it-all, one-size-fits-all dictates from St. Paul on the one hand, and kind of the wild, wild west status quo, which is no regulation whatsoever or no guidance really whatsoever. And I think we found that sweet spot. House File 2774, which is the one that's formally before you right now, is pretty simple. It consists of three parts. The first is just saying that there ought to be a state elections emergency plan. The plan would be written by our office in consultation with the Department of Public Safety, the Division of Homeland Security, and Emergency Management. So that's number one. Number two is that our office would then create kind of a template, a model plan for counties to implement at the local level. They could cut and paste and pick and choose. They could take some of it, all of it, none of it. But it would be a template, a model that we would have in place by this spring, certainly by this summer. And then the final piece is that the counties themselves would be required to have an emergency plan. It doesn't have to be 100 pages. It could be a fraction of that. But they'll have a template. They'll have a model to pick and choose from. And I think as the legislative members who were on the task force can attest, we heard testimony then from several folks at the county level. They actually want this. And I've met face-to-face with several dozen of them, and I always ask, do you want this? If you don't want it, we won't do it. But to a person, they all said they actually want this. It's a perhaps unique situation of counties saying, yes, please make us do this. As long as we have the template, they don't want to start from scratch. As long as they have something from our office where they can cut, paste, pick, choose, they're not only okay with it, they actually want this in place. So that really is the bill, 2774. I don't know if Representative Fenton or Mr. Chair, you wanted us to talk about the next bill now or wait until that's formally before you, but I'll stop there, assuming you just want me to stop. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Secretary Simon and Representative Fenton. Another thing that came out during these meetings that we had is that a lot of people don't realize that 9/11 happened on primary election day in New York. And so this is what, you know, they, and they had no plan. So this is what we're looking at, is some sort of just a template or a way to, so that if something unforeseen happens, that, oh, this is what I do, and pull it off the shelf, it could take care of it. I think, like Secretary Simon said, I think we kind of hit the sweet spot there with this bill.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any other member questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As someone who served on the Government Operations and Elections Commission, committee here in the House since I arrived, I have just a couple of procedural questions that maybe Representative Nelson or Representative Fenton or Secretary Simon could help us with. I'm also very supportive of putting the emergency plan in. What's the definition of emergency? And let me just digress a little bit. Very warm day on our first day of session, approaching 70 degrees in the first part of March, kind of unseasonable. We had an armistice day blizzard here in the state of Minnesota a number of years ago, and so we could have the potential of weather events on election day here in the state of Minnesota. How does that, who calls and says, you know what, we can't have elections on elections day because we have the armistice day equivalency on election day? Right now the governor has authority to be able to close schools statewide. Would that rest with the governor? Would that rest with your office, Mr. Secretary? Or is a snowstorm as an event not considered part of the emergency plan?
Mr. Secretary, or Representative Fenton, you guys decide.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, 204B is the section of statute that deals explicitly with emergencies, but those are emergencies at the state level. And the most recent one that I can think of is the avian flu, the bird flu that we had last year, when the governor, in conjunction then afterwards with the executive council, declared an emergency in certain counties, Kandy, Ojai, and others, and there are definitions in 204B. Here, though, we thought we wanted to give local elections officials maximum flexibility. There's still those definitions in 204B, and this pertains probably more to the next bill that will be before you, 2775, but generally speaking, to defer to them in declaring what that would be. And I think the language in the bill is something like an emergency condition, that sort of thing. And, you know, we were weighing how prescriptive to be to local folks. We erred on the side of not being prescriptive, of not sort of smothering them with definitions. But Ms. Strother, if I could, Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Strother might have something to add to that, perhaps not, because she helped staff the task force.
Go ahead. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Strother.
Mr. Chair, Julie Strother with the Secretary of State's office. It's Chapter 12 that has the emergency authority in it and the definition of an emergency and the governor's powers under an emergency. This bill here doesn't provide additional authority to the locals or the state in the case of emergency, but instead requires that they create a plan under our current laws and framework, but it doesn't give additional authority to the governor, and instead requires that we create a plan under the current framework, if that answers your question.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome. I'm not saying that it's the governor who would have the authority. I'm just asking the question, who would, in contemplating this, the implementation and creation of the provisions, who would have the ultimate, Harry Truman, the buck stops here, to make those kinds of decisions? And I guess we could also have regional-related issues within the state versus a statewide. Not that I expect answers, I just want comfort at this point in the process as we consider voting this out today, that those things are in the forefront of the Secretary's office mind as they're formulating policy.
Ms. Strother.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so this contemplates emergencies from, you know, a water main breaks in the polling place and you need to move the location. Like, that's an emergency under this, and coming up with the that is in the next bill as well. But you know, what is the procedure for if you run out of ballot, so there's a fire alarm and you have to move out of the building? It contemplates creating procedures for those types of emergencies, but those are the emergencies that the local officials now have the authority to address under the current parameters of law. Something like a snowstorm that might affect half the state, that would be something that the governor, under his current Chapter 12 authority, would have to determine whether or not he has the authority under current state law to postpone an election, move an election. My understanding, the federal government has looked at this. It's sort of an open question about whether you can move a federal election, which is our November general elections. But that's under current Chapter 12 authority.
Representative Nelson at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Ms. Struthers covered what I was going to say. They range from the local precinct, in our discussions in the committee, from the local precinct losing power, bomb threat, any number of things that could happen, just one precinct or one city, to up to something that would affect the whole state. And there's and the reaction in what you'd have to take in between, and it gives the flexibility of the local elected or the local election officials to be able to determine if it needs to be done, and then a procedure of who to go to. And that's what this is setting up or trying to set up is in the whole process.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is the first bill, 2774, is very much a guideline, and I think it was the consensus of the entire task force to really leave things in the hands of at the local level and at a last resort only. And that's so that was 2774, but there's a little bit more detail for last resort only instances in bill number 2775, which we'll be hearing next.
Thank you. Any other member questions or discussion to this bill? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, in your comments, you mentioned about, you know, kind of the paraphrase, cut and paste, and the in this opportunity for the counties to determine or make self-determination in terms of what provisos they want to include in their own disaster management plan. But are we, in a sense, subjecting the state then to potential litigation? And this may be addressed in 2775, I don't know, but I'll just ask the question now. So let's say that we have a flooding event, if we're talking about an early primary, whether it's in the Red River Basin or it could be in southwestern Minnesota, but you have one county that's fully flooded, but you have half of another county right adjacent to it that isn't. And so if you've got similar but dissimilar contingency disaster plans embraced, and you've got two political parties, as Representative Nelson, you know, I think expressed well, don't you actually encourage litigation based upon the outcome, based upon the circumstances that each county takes? And it's embedded in the differentiation of the contingency plans that they put in place.
Mr. Secretary.
Yeah, that's a great question, actually, and thank you for it. As you know, that's been the subject in other contexts of litigation in terms of whether the experience was uniform. And our best conclusion was almost certainly not, that we would not subject ourselves to litigation. We'll never know unless there's actual litigation, but we think this kind of uniform system sets out sufficient uniformity in terms of, look, we're going to have a model plan. Counties can choose to include none of it, some of it, or all of it, but ultimately we didn't think, and I will say today, I don't think that a court would make an adverse determination based on a county's decision to tailor an emergency plan for its own needs. There may be all sorts of geographical reasons or logistic reasons or people power reasons why this county or that county might do things differently. I would predict, I haven't always been right, but I would predict that a court would say that's not enough to create kind of an equal protection constitutional kind of problem in terms of disparate treatment among county lines. But it's a great question because that comes up a lot. It came up in the Frank and Coleman recount. And it's always a live issue, but we thought that was a very remote possibility.
Mr.
Always
Chair.
Possible, but remote.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Secretary Simon, then, so maybe the comfort that I'm getting from your comments is that there's a baseline threshold that you're going to provide as a template to the counties, and they can, at their own peril, per se, elect to add to it or leave it as is.
Right.
Mr. Secretary.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, one of the things that the legislation provides is that in crafting these plans, in addition to cutting and pasting and so forth, they are required to consult, at least with local emergency folks. And all of them say they want to do that anyway. And so I have a high degree of confidence in their ability to do the right thing. They're very conscientious about this. They see the need for this. All of them have told me so. And it was the strong consensus of the group to do this. I will say one thing that we didn't do is we just said that they had, that counties had to file this with our office. But what we very consciously did not do, we discussed it but decided not to, is have any sort of authority for our office to, you know, vet or screen or reject plans or anything like that. You could certainly give us that authority. We decided not to seek it, and the consensus on the commission was it wasn't really necessary. But I suppose one theoretical way to make it uniform would be for us, or anyone else for that matter, to kind of standardize them somehow, as by suggesting amendments or somehow rejecting them. We decided that was a little heavy-handed and not necessary at this point. But we'll see if you decide this is the way you want to go. We'll see what the first crop of emergency plans look like, and they'll be public, so you'll be able to see them as well. But we decided that was a little too heavy-handed for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any final member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Fenton renews her motion that House File 2774 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 2774 is on its way to public safety. And with that, our final bill of the day, Representative Fenton, House File 2775.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2775, I make a motion to move to the General Registry.
Representative Fenton moves House File 2775 to the General Register. Representative Fenton, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2775 provides procedures for combining or moving a polling place in the event of an emergency. And with that, I will turn it over to Secretary Simon to make a few comments.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, this has been kind of interwoven with the previous bill, but you know, mm-hmm. to use Representative Driscoll's terminology, we know the Harry Trumans in this analogy are the local folks, the county auditors or auditor treasurers in most cases, the local election administrators. But this is making sure that the Harry Trumans have a couple of extra tools to exercise the authority. And under current law right now, believe it or not, you can only relocate a polling place on election day. Even if the pipe burst 2 days before and you know it's not likely to be cleaned up in time for the election, technically, you can perhaps announce that you're going to move it, but you can't actually move it until election day. So this is a way to conform the law to, we think, common sense, and that was a strong consensus of the task force. And also gives local elections officials the authority, within some very tight parameters, to expand polling place hours, and only so far as is necessary to travel to the new polling place, which in greater Minnesota can be a big issue. So if the pipe bursts in the middle of election day and the polling place is disabled somehow because of an evacuation for a number of hours and they have to relocate the polling place, we decided that the fairest way, so that you didn't have someone, for example, because of a one-hour delay, opening polls for an extra 4 hours, we decided that the fairest measurement of how much longer it should be open is the distance it would take to travel. Assuming you were in line at 7:59 p.m., and now you have to travel to some other destination, keeping it open for a time that is measured by the reasonable time it takes to get to that next destination. That's what we could come up with. It was reasonable, so you didn't have hijinks on election night with people saying, well, we're going to open the poll for 12 hours because the pipe burst for an hour. So that was our best way of accommodating common sense in that way. So that's really it for this particular bill.
Excellent. Any other member questions, comments, discussion? Seeing none, Representative Fenton renews her motion that House File 2775 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2775 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you again, Mr. Secretary, for being here today. You and your office, we appreciate it. You're always welcome. Members, thank you for a good, productive day today. We will be sending out probably a list of bills that we will be considering on Tuesday later this afternoon. So be on the lookout for that. Otherwise, we will see you all on Tuesday. I hope everyone has a great weekend. We are adjourned.